Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight and overcoming the trauma in Sydney caused by Oprah's arrival here, which has made life very difficult for many people. It's great to have Tony Moore back at the Sydney Institute. I think the last time Tony Moore was here, he spoke about his book on Barry Humphries. But he also has spoken here on the ABC. So it's great to have Tony Moore back on the occasion of the publication of Death or Liberty, Rebels and Radicals Transported to Australia, 1788 to 1868. I'll introduce Tony Moore briefly. He's a writer and historian and an academic based in Melbourne. He has a PhD in Australian history from the University of Sydney, and he's director of the National Centre for Australian Studies at Monash University in Melbourne. Tony's career has also spanned political activism, documentary making at the ABC, journalism and book publishing. And he writes regularly on culture, history and politics. And of course his last book was the Barry McKenzie movies. And tonight the topic of Tony Moore's talk is Convicts to Heroes, Our Forgotten Republican Tradition. Tony Moore, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, and thank you for inviting me to talk tonight, and thank you for all coming out tonight so close to Christmas. And the mic is working, I believe? Great, fantastic. I'm getting some multifocal glasses in a week, but I've still got my old reading glasses, so forgive if I change a bit like this. It's all about old age or middle age. What I wanted to do tonight was begin by talking a little bit about contemporary republicanism in Australia, or the lack thereof. And there's been a little bit of a debate since our Prince William and Kate Middleton decided to announce their engagement. And I'm old enough to remember the days when Diana and Charles announced their engagement. Diana was the same age as me, and I wish them better luck than that than William's parents had with their marriage. But it's caused a little bit of a rumbling. And I spoke to the Australian Republican movement a few weeks ago on this matter. So before jumping into the historical tale I want to tell, I just want to say a little bit about the Republican debate today. No symbol of our nation's sovereignty hangs in our children's classrooms. Education departments, and presumably politicians, parents and students, don't consider our actual sovereign, Queen Elizabeth II, or her appointed representative, the Governor-General, appropriate icons of 21st century Australia. No one even protests where members of the royal family, including our future kings, are mobilised to spruik the trade of another nation or even a soccer bid. Yet republics have failed to fill the void. The result? Dazzled by the glamour of a prospective royal wedding, my 12-year-old daughter has become a monarchist. Shame. She is not alone. In an Australia not yet purged of its colonial habits, the mystery and majesty of England's thousand-year monarchy remains a force to reckon with. To seize the day, I believe Republicans must mobilise an alternative dream of Australia, one that appeals to the heart as well as the head, to the land as well as the law, forgotten heroes as well as the future. It's got to be about democracy from the bottom up, as opposed to the current obsession with the head of state and rule by a narrow political class. Now, what has been missing in this tumultuous political year, beyond the refrain and a terrible song, "What About Me?", is a narrative of where our leaders will take Australia. Now, when it came to the Republic, Gillard channeled St. Augustine, "Yes, Lord, but not quite yet." I say the coming Republic is the narrative, but not just electing an Australian head of state. Its watchwords are citizenship, democratic renewal, and a generous self-sacrificing patriotism. Now, in 1999, the Australian people rightly rejected a Republican model which did nothing about the whiff of oligarchy in Australian political practice. One where parliamentarians chose the president. But whatever the model, this obsession with the apex of the political pyramid neglects the people on which any notion of res publica must be based. I'm in favour of a maximalist rather than a minimalist republic, but one focused on the advance of bottom-up democracy within our polity and on changes that, if we get time in Q&A, I'll discuss, which don't even require a referendum. But to rally Australians, we must harness culture and history to our cause. Colonialism is not just apparent in malingering practices of governance, but in the cultural amnesia that sees us imbibe the history of the metropolitan societies of America and Britain, but remain ignorant of all but a handful of individuals and events. To prevail in the culture and constitutional wars to come, to imagine Australia as a republic, we must first decolonise our memories. What I found very surprising is how few Australian Republicans, and I absent some of the Irish activists here, but many of the Australian Republicans don't know the stories of the Republican martyrs that were transported to the Australian colonies as political prisoners in the convict era. And it's to this that I want to turn tonight. Now, growing up in the suburbs of the Illawarra in the 1970s, I shared the prejudice of many school children that the great events of history happened elsewhere, while my own country appeared untroubled by violent conflict or the clash of ideas. I didn't know at that stage that Australia had had a robust, sometimes bloody history of dissent, and that the colonies were vitally connected to revolution sweeping the world. Now, this other past is a lot closer than we think. In researching this book, I learnt that in an old cemetery in my hometown of Dapto, 1 kilometre from my mother's house, lay buried a French-Canadian revolutionary named Joseph Marceau, transported as a convict in 1839 along with 57 compatriots for rebellion against the British Empire. Now, in Sydney's Botanical Gardens lies another humble grave belonging to Scotsman Joseph Gerald. Now, this I'm a bit of a rebel stalker because this little humble grave is not far from where my wedding reception was held. Now, Joseph Gerald was exiled over the seas for the sedition of advocating universal suffrage. He weakened during the voyage over and died in 1796, aged 36. Now, the understated resting place of the Canadian rebel and the British radical disturb our conventional understandings of convicts as criminals and begs the question, why don't we learn stories of such people at school and in our civic commemoration? What can we learn from their struggles? Now, few Australians realise that some 3,600 rebels, radicals and protesters were transported as political prisoners here in the late 18th and throughout the 19th century to the last convict transport in 1868, delivered a cargo of Fenians. Now, death or liberty was a rallying cry of a constant stream of exiles, including liberals, Democrats and especially Republicans, English machine breakers, trade unionists and charters, radical journalists, preachers and intellectuals, and of course, Irish, Canadian and even American revolutionaries. While viewed by the British government with the same alarm as today's terrorists, the political prisoners are today revered in their homelands as freedom fighters and patriots. Yet in Australia, the land of their exile, memory of these martyrs has dimmed. Now, this is surprising, as many of the principles for which the prisoners were transported, freedom of speech, publishing and assembly, universal suffrage, responsible government, animate both sides of politics. Now, those of us championing an Australian Republic can salute political prisoners like, a bit of a slideshow here, it's an occupational hazard as I'm a university lecturer. Yeah, it's pretty good. I did a road test on it. Those of us that support the Republican idea should know that the Republican DNA was transported into Australia from the earliest days of settlement. Now, Thomas Muir was a dashing young orator and idealist in the Jeffersonian mould, whose crusade for electoral reform morphed into republicanism under persecution and in the hopeful dawn of the French Revolution. Now, he had an interesting time of it. He was one of 5 Scottish martyrs. They were supported by the rising Whig politician, their cause, William Pitt the Younger, in the early days of his career. But things got muddied with new laws on sedition after the French Revolution started to descend into terror. And some of the works that these people were distributing were banned, particularly the works of Tom Paine. Now, it's important to understand they're not socialists. At this stage, not even Republicans. They are radical liberals. Radical in the context of their time. What they want, universal suffrage, short parliaments, an end of corruption, particularly the reform of rotten boroughs for industrial towns that aren't returning members, which will form the basis of a liberal program throughout the 19th century. But at the time, in the context of the French Revolution, they fell foul of, I guess, a war on terror of a sort. Now, that terror being the terror of the French Revolution. Now, Muir was the first political prisoner transported to Australia. What's interesting about these people is it's not only liberty in political terms that they're after, in freedom from the state, but the basic belief, if you're going to tax me, most of them were sons of the rising bourgeoisie, if you're going to tax me, you'll jolly well give me representation, the old American cry. But also, they believed they were free marketeers. So, as gentlemen, on being transported, those that didn't perish from the terrible sea voyage were given freedom of the colony. They were given land, and able to farm. But they actually believed in free trade, and they came up against Sydney's first developer monopoly, the Rum Corps. And Thomas Palmer, one of them, who was also a reverend, a Unitarian minister, started out first with his with a colleague who came out with him, one of our first trading firms, Boston and Company. They had a copy of the Encyclopedia Britannica with them, so they learned how to brew beer and spirits and started trading against the Rum Corps. And when the Rum Corps tried to impinge on them, took them to court. There was a case about a cow that the Rum Corps maimed that belonged to this trading company. They also used the Encyclopedia Britannica to build a boat to sail to Norfolk Island and were allowed to trade with it, not the prisoners themselves, but agents they employed. So what's interesting is that a kind of free trade capitalism is carried with these guys too. Now, another... And I should say of Muir, just going back to Muir, he was a new media guy. He should be understood. He was sentenced for sedition, he and the fellow Scottish martyrs, for what they wrote, for pamphlets. They fronted corresponding societies, which set about sending letters of evidence to mount their case. They believed in rational argument. So the Adams brothers in the American Revolution had formed one of the first corresponding societies in Boston. And what's interesting is the parallels, if you read in my book about their trials, they used language which is not dissimilar to that used by new media activists and citizen journalists today, and even with the WikiLeaks story. And the trials are very interesting to read. But Muir couldn't be contained in Sydney, and I'll get to that a little bit later. Now, Dwyer was a revolutionary braveheart. He was... a hero of the 1798 United Irish Revolution. After that revolution had early success, it was an attempt, I won't go into the details now of that revolution, but United Irish, because it united Presbyterian nonconformist with Irish Catholic and bourgeois with peasant and working people. People from the country with people of the city. And they had early success, but ultimately the British army and the militias prevailed. But Michael Dwyer and a Protestant commander, General Holt, were not to surrender, and they went into the Wicklow Mountains and held out against the British army for a number of years. That's why I say an Irish braveheart, a guerrilla fighter. He was ultimately, members of his family were apprehended, and he was told he would get free passage to the US if he surrendered. And by then, the jig was really up for this revolution. But instead, he was transported as a prisoner of war to Australia. Now, today, Dwyer is honoured with one of the largest monuments to the United Irish Revolution at Waverley Cemetery, not far from where Henry Lawson's memorial stone is. And people, Irish expats, Irish Australians, people that remember this struggle, go there to pay honour to Michael Dwyer. And in fact, at the centenary of the 1798 revolution, the Irish community of Sydney dedicated this monument and moved the bodies of Dwyer and his wife Mary to Waverley Cemetery. That one's for John O. Johnson. But a number of Australian politicians of Irish extraction do honour this man to this day. Now, Dwyer was the Pike guy, a ridgy-didge warrior and guerrilla, and Muir was the new media guy. Two different sorts of bravery, one moral force of rational argument, the other physical force, a willingness to fight for change in the streets and the fields and in the mind. Both men had the strength of their convictions. That's General Holt, who was a Protestant larger landowner. Now, other political prisoners included the Tolpuddle Martyrs, who were they formed one of the first agricultural unions in the southern part of England. This followed 4 years after the Swing Riots that ripped through the green and pleasant lands of southern England, and that was your more primitive form of rebellion. This was a more modern form. 500 swing riders were transported to New South Wales and Van Diemen's Land, but these five men plus another, led by George Lovelace, caused more consternation to the British government than the swing riders, because they were organised, because they were modern, and a rather clever attempt to outlaw unionism at a time when it was legal, using old legislation about unlawful acts, kind of backfired in the end, because a huge mass movement developed around the Tolpuddle Martyrs to seek their pardon, and in the end they were pardoned, and they, in fact, they're the only case of political prisoners having their fares paid back by the Crown, and they came back to be heroes, early heroes of the Chartist movement. But a common thread for many of the political prisoners was not just that they were activists, and that some of them were pro-capitalist, and others, such as this, were early unionists. Many were Christians. I mentioned Presbyterians and Catholics. Most of the Tolpuddle Martyrs were Methodists, and they were part of that early relationship between Methodism and the Labour movement. And George Lovelace, their leader, was a lay preacher, a Methodist lay preacher, and that was more or less his university. In 1837 to 1839, there were a series of revolutions in Upper Lower Canada, that's Quebec, or the French part of Canada, and the British part of Canada. There were lots of... The revolutions failed one after the other. There were lots of executions, and a lot of people were arrested. Many were pardoned. One of the governors of Upper Canada was the same... Arthur, who Port Arthur is named after. Now, to make matters worse, there were radical American Democrats invaded Canada, both Canadas, lower and upper, along the US border. They formed what were called secret hunting lodges, secret armies, that had incursions and invasions, one after the other. Hundreds and hundreds crossed the border, and there were many arrests. 92 were transported to Australia, somewhat illegally, because the first bunch went via London, and there was some celebrity trials, and it rallied radicals who wanted more autonomy for the Canadian colonies. So the next bunch was sent direct from Canada to Australia, which was not quite right, because they were two colonies without proper force of elected government, and that would later cause difficulty for the British, and ultimately secured their pardons. But this is Linus Miller, one of the Americans. He was a law clerk, and a number of Americans and French wrote spirited pamphlets, and that's a sort of important part of it. Another, that these people, many of them, were not your pickpocket type convicts. Many were educated people, and this is another one, Xavier Prieur. He wrote the French Canadians ended up in Sydney. They were meant for Norfolk Island as Catholics. The Bishop of Sydney took up their case, boarded the ship, explained to the governor they would not be able to take mass in as French Catholics. They wouldn't be able to take mass in Norfolk Island, and so they were allowed to be detained in Sydney at around Concord in what we now call Canada Bay and Exile Bay. What's interesting is they laboured on the Parramatta Road, so blame them if it doesn't quite work as it should. But they also, being French prisoners, quickly started making wine and baking bread, and in fact ended up taking getting rid of their commandant, who was a lazy and corrupt official, and sort of ended up running their own jail at Concord, a very Hogan's Heroes situation. In 1848 was the Young Ireland Revolution, which George Rideau, who wrote the classic book on political prisoners, he crunched the numbers back in a book written in the 70s called Protest and Punishment. He didn't care too much for the Young Islanders because they were all intellectuals. They weren't the salt of the earth, working class and peasant folk. But I'm actually quite intrigued by them because they started a magazine. They split from the Irish Repeal movement that was pursuing repeal through moral force, through a almost Gandhian sense of turn the other cheek and monster conventions. They came to the conclusion, once the horrors of the potato famine hit Ireland, that that force was necessary, reluctantly. And they split from the repeal movement. But they had a magazine, a newspaper called The Nation, which formed an early style of nationalism for that revived the notion of Irish antiquity and an Irish island racy of the soil. That was their expression, which the Bulletin magazine later adopted. And I've looked through these newspapers, and they're very inspiring. They use poetry. They evolved in the Celtic language, and created an image of what a free and independent Ireland might be like. And in political or social change, the idea of the imagined community is really important. It's important for the growth of nationalism. And 1848, of course, was the year of liberal nationalist revolutions. And I hasten to add again, they're not revolutionary socialists, they're liberal revolutionaries. Perhaps John Mitchell, some would say, one of these men, lent a bit almost to an almost quasi-fascist idealisation of the agrarian peasantry. And he wanted land redistribution. But for the most part, they were liberals. Their leader was William Smith O'Brien, who was an aristocrat. His ancestor was Brian Boru, the medieval Irish king. He was a member of the House of Commons. His brother was a lord in the House of Lords, related to Queen Victoria. He, at a particular point, crossed over and joined with these younger men, John Mitchell, particularly McManus, Marr, and Thomas Davis, and joined Young Ireland. And they're quite an intriguing group. And we might talk about them in the Q&A. Now, the important point I want to make is that it's wrong to think that freedom, democracy and self-government were handed to the Australian colonies by an enlightened mother country without struggle. These rights had to be fought for by true believers making a stand throughout the empire, many of whom had to fight again as political prisoners in the Australian colonies to keep their causes alive before the world. From the Scottish Jacobins and United Irishmen in the early days of the Sydney settlement to the working class Chartists and the gentlemen young island intellectuals, political convicts made a mark on their place of banishment. As we know, rising in violent rebellion at Castle Hill, that's the cover of the book, that famous picture, promoting economic development as business leaders, publishing radical journals such as the Irish Felon to agitate in Van Diemen's Land for liberal reforms and even Aboriginal rights. I can't get over the fact that these guys are sent from their own country for seditious journalism, the Young Islanders, but in Tasmania, they're allowed to write a journal. And it's in part because the convict officials are a bit intimidated by them. These people pursue... Convicts have rights at law, as we know from John Hurst's excellent work in this area. It's wrong to picture it as the gulag that Robert Hughes portrays. And the Young Islanders in particular were quite zealous in pursuing those rights. At one point, they threw out... There was a case that found none of the statutes that enabled the imprisonment of the Irish convicts in Australia were in the colony. And the magistrate said, well, unless we get those statutes very quickly, they can all be released. And he released the young islander in question. They would have all had to go to law. But they were very good in that Eddie Mabo way of pursuing their rights, and many convicts were. George Lovelace, the Tolpuddle martyr, took his overseer to court and won. So this is something worth noting. But an important point is that the Chartists and the Young Islanders in particular became involved in the anti-transportation movement, which was, people don't just wake up and say, we want our colonies to be independent. What they say is, we don't want you to send convicts here anymore. We want a labour market, a free labour market. We want to pursue a different fate for our colonies. And the British government says, no, you'll take them. And that becomes the cause. That's the Boston Tea Party moment. And the Young Islanders, in fact, became figureheads for the anti-transportation movement and newspapers, the majority of which were anti-transportation, pursuing what Canada, the Canadian colonies, had now achieved, which was a form of autonomy that gave Britain power over foreign policy, but the Canadian colonies a great deal of power over their own domestic policy, and increased representation in the parliaments of Canada. So these people became figureheads to the extent that William Smith O'Brien was being put forward as a candidate for governor, satirically I might add, but being put forward in place of Denison. In fact, it became a struggle between Smith O'Brien and Denison. Denison the plan of the British government was that these fellows, being gentlemen, would be given parole and be allowed to, I guess, live in a gilded cage. Smith O'Brien refused parole and was put in ended up in solitary, and his health started to falter. They were too scared to stop him writing letters. His letter-writing campaign rallied the Irish in New York and rallied the Irish in Dublin, but also the British. And it was Gladstone championed him in the House of Commons. He became the Free Smith O'Brien campaign became huge, similar, I guess, to the Mandela one in recent times. And their revolution had been a debacle. They weren't very good revolutionaries. They were better writers than revolutionaries. But by using PR and the courts and the concept of martyrdom, they're actually able to resurrect their cause. And so the cause of a free island. And that's something I explore in the book. I'm very interested in the theatre of courts and punishment. Now, a number of radicals were talented writers, and for that reason there's a wealth of records. In fact, most of what we know about convicts comes from their accounts of other convicts. Now, some of them, like William Smith O'Brien, who is a bit of a noblesse oblige character, wrote very well about working class and underclass convicts and Aborigines. Others, like John Mitchell, despised them. A lot of the political prisoners, and particularly the Americans, presented Australia as this servile place and didn't want to be connected with these political prisoners. So that's very interesting. Now, often these people were pardoned because of these campaigns and returned to their countries. Xavier Prieur, who I showed you earlier, one-time revolutionary prisoner, rose to become Canada's superintendent of prisons in the new federated prisons, which I thought was pretty ironic. Young Island Rebel, the sort of, if you were making a movie of it, and Keneally practically did a movie of it in The Great Shame, the young handsome fellow, he'd be the hero to the Stuart Granger could play William Smith O'Brien, I suppose, and the more handsome young guy is Tom Maher up the top there. He escaped, as did John Mitchell, on American ships. The Americans are forever rescuing people. Very porous prison, this one. And Maher ended up a general on the Union side in the Civil War in America. He was welcomed with open arms by the Democratic Party in the United States, and after the war became a Democratic Party governor of Montana, which is an interesting end, given he was a governor of Denison in Tasmania. Now, political convicts undoubtedly suffered under the cruelties of the system. Some endured the harsh regimes of Norfolk Island and Port Arthur and had their lives cut short, like Joseph Gerald. But many working-class machine breakers, peasant riders and chartists enjoyed material improvement and even social mobility in the colonies. And after serving their sentences, remained to build a new country, like Joseph Marceau, my native Dapto, who married an Australian girl and died a respected farmer and grocer in 1883. He was known in Dapto as Honest Joe. Now, rebel warrior Michael Dwyer enjoyed an Irish trifecta after his pardon, becoming a policeman, publican and folk singer. In fact, he fell foul of Governor Bligh. The New South Wales Corps loved him because he was the sort of guy that could command people, hence why he became a policeman. One of the Scottish martyrs became involved in the Castle Hill Rebellion. General Holt was blamed for being involved. He claims in his memoir he was involved. He was sent to Norfolk Island. But later on, things become better for the convicts. You know, they get more rights, as John Hurst has shown us. Chartist William Cuffey, the son of a West Indian slave in London, became a Tasmanian union leader and spearheaded the campaign to reform the colony's Punitive Masters and Servants Act. A young Islander publisher, seditionist and medical student, Kevin O'Doherty, he's probably the first international student in Australia, he studied medicine in Tasmania. He returned to Australia after being pardoned, came back and set up a gynecological practice in Brisbane and was elected to Queensland's Legislative Assembly, where he championed its first health act. An earlier Kevin from Queensland, if you like, who had more success with health reform than the latter one. He campaigned against blackbirding of kanakas before serving in the House of Commons on an Irish Home Rule ticket. Now, it's very interesting that These people actually make a mark on Australian political culture. The constitutions of the 1850s are greatly in New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, elsewhere, Queensland, are greatly influenced by Chartist principles. And both Liberal and Labor historians rightly call those constitutions Chartists. People talk about the Eureka Stockade. A number of Chartists and former Young Ireland members are involved in that, including the brother of James Fintan Lalor, Peter Lalor. James Fintan Lalor was one of the more radical Young Islanders. So what I sketch in the book is it is artificial to hive Australia off from Britain, the United States, Canada. The world is connected. There's a number of forms of globalisation going on at this time. One is trade, one is the British Empire, one is a media connectivity that's happening, and another is the very notion of these radical movements, which are both cosmopolitan and nationalistic. So the journalists, like Karl Marx, beavering away in the British Museum, but also writing for a New York newspaper. These fellows write for papers around the world. They're connected, but they also drill down nationally. But I say in the book, we should think of the Australian colonies in the 19th century as less about roots, R-O-O-T-S, than roots, R-O-U-T-E-S. And no one exhibits this better than Thomas Muir, who I started with. Now, Muir escaped on an American fur trading ship. He went through Polynesia. There was an island named after him. They went up to Canada. He was involved in trading furs up there and was presented with a sort of dried, severed head for his trouble by Native Americans. The British nearly apprehended him. He got on board a Spanish ship. The Spanish said that they would convey him to America. He was promised asylum by the US government. George Washington was involved in that. But on board the ship, the Viceroy of New Spain became worried by this radical fellow, even though he was called a Jacobin by his enemies and had been in France and made a citizen of France at one point. They considered him a British spy. He was detained in Mexico and ends up in a prison in Cuba, not far from Guantanamo Bay, which is a lot worse than his little farm in Blues Point in Sydney. He's then ferried back to Spain to face trial. The British fleet come upon the ship off off the coast, and Muir is at his trial. Muir is hit in the face with shrapnel and loses his eye, and is pretty badly disfigured, actually. So disfigured that when he's in a hospital on the Belgian shores, he's not recognised for the public enemy number one that he is. And no less than Talleyrand intervenes to spirit him out of that country into France. And he ends up now decisively on the French side, advising Napoleon, and as the head of the Scottish Directorate in exile. That invasion of Britain, of course, never happened. But he very quickly became sceptical of the French government and the authoritarianism. It was hardly a liberal environment, and died a pauper on Australia Day in the late 1790s. There is no Australia Day at that time, but you know the date. Thomas Marr came to a sticky and grisly end. He disappeared off a boat. Some say he drowned when he was drunk. Others say Republican vigilantes that controlled Montana had a say in that, so there are conspiracy theories abounding. But Australia was inspired, an inspiring legacy. The stories of Muir, Dwyer and Marceau reveal a contested empire in which dissent and revolution jostle with hope and glory. Citizens of the American Republic are part of this history, exporting their radical brand of democracy into the territories of the British superpower, hatching daring rescues of political prisoners like the Catalpa breakout to embarrass the great empire, and suffering transportation to our shores, as I mentioned. There was a fellow back here, John Boyle O'Reilly. He was on the last convict transport. He was one of the Fenian mutineers. After the Indian mutiny, the Fenians, which had arisen sort of from the failure of the Young Ireland Revolution, he was a soldier, but also a poet and journalist. On the basis of the Indian mutiny, they got the idea of hatching revolution from within the British armed forces. But that, as always with many of these secret plans, informers betrayed it. The government swooped, and they were transported, as I said, on the last convict transport, which took them to Western Australia. He actually escaped from, I think, four British penitentiaries before he was transported to Australia, and they particularly wanted these soldier mutineers out of Britain. And this was the point where the Fenians were beginning to descend into terrorism as opposed to revolution, and they wanted them out of the country. Not surprisingly, John Boyle O'Reilly escaped again, ended up in New York, in Boston, where he started a magazine called The Pilot. And a number of these Fenians were rescued by the New York branch of the Fenians, Clan na Gael, aboard the Catalpa ship, a whaler that they hired. And I tell the story in the book, and Thomas Keneally's book gives a very spirited account of that. Just to end, liberalism, republicanism, trade unionism, working class politics, democracy, responsible government and post-colonial nationalism all arrived in the colonies in chains. Yet through the alchemy of martyrdom, spirited resistance, canny campaigning back home and in the colonies, and dramatic escapes, these radical ideas broke free of convict fetters to disseminate around the world, and they became the common sense of liberal nation states and left strong influences in Australia's political culture. In particular, if we look at the notion of republicanism, we can talk about this perhaps in a second in the questions, they weren't so fussed about heads of state. Their idea of republicanism was involving the public more in government. So the expansion of democracy and the elimination of corruption and accountability. And that's what their pamphlets speak about. They were happy even to have a crowned republic. And a lot of their supporters in Australia came to the conclusion that they pretty well were on the way to achieving that with the constitutions of the 1850s. And my advice to the republican movement is they need to talk less about the head of state and the royal family and more about expanding expanding democracy in Australia, and most of that is to do with practice and legislation, not to do with the constitution. And these people were experts at using culture, as I mentioned, but finally they were prepared to sacrifice their own lives or liberty for a cause in which they believed. I leave you with the thought, what are we prepared to sacrifice our liberty for? What cause are we prepared to? Because political and social change isn't just handed to us, and the Federation Constitution and the colonial constitutions were not just handed to us. These people went the hard yards for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Well, since you asked, I would sacrifice my liberty for a ticket to Oprah today.
See, those Americans are still involved.
Now, we have some copies of, Janet Grundy's got some copies of Death or Liberty, Rebels and Radicals Transported to Australia, 1788 to 1868. So we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. Just quickly, first up, of the ones you went through today, I probably was aware of one of them, I guess. But of the figures from the 19th century, people of an Irish background, let's talk about the Irish. There are others you covered, but the only one I think anyone really knows is Ned Kelly, I guess. So why do you think these figures didn't leave much of an impact? They left some impact, but not much.
Part of the joy of researching the book was not just reading their own works, which are many, because they were literate people and they left records, but reading Commonwealth history from the 1940s and 50s. And when I spoke to my father-in-law when I started this book, he said, oh, I know about these people, we learn about them at school. So when we had a more of a sense, ironically, of imperial belonging, belonging to the empire, people used to learn New Zealand history. People used to learn South African history and Canadian history. They knew what the Durham Report was. So people like Muir and the Tolpuddle Martyrs were more widely known. I actually think, ironically, some of the revolutions in or rebellions in history about being more nationalistic in the 70s led to that OOTS, that roots notion, which has a place for Ned Kelly and the 1880s and 90s bulletin, and then Humphrey McQueen critiqued that. And then, but it threw out the notion of a transnational 19th century history, which is actually makes history exciting. We know, you've just been to America and Oprah's here, we know we live in a global world. We do our Australian, rooted in Australia stuff, and we have local councils and state governments, federal, but we also are, through the internet and journalism and reading the New Yorker, we live in a global thing. And I think they threw out that notion in the way it's taught in school. So we all know the horse, the cricketer, we go gold panning at Hill End, but it's all a bit parochial and hokey. And it disconnects Australia, which was a vital part of the big oil trade route of the time, i.e. Wales, and the seal trade, the fur trade, the trade from India. The British Empire was a dynamic force in the world. And there is a new thing, the new imperial history, or the new critical imperial history, which is, and Anne Curthwas, I guess, made a speech about this a decade ago, we need to rediscover the transnationality. And I guess because of globalisation being a phrase, it's kind of led to a renewal in empire history. And I think that's why, Jared, I think we've got those lefties in the 70s to blame in a funny kind of way.
That's good. Okay, so
Tony, it's bigger than that, though, isn't it? Through Bette Smith's book and other sort of reactions to Robert Hughes. I mean, if you look at Australian history, the early stuff is full of these kind of spirited, where we can be what we want to be. And then there's this huge reaction to the idea that we have a stain, that we're convict begun. And I was at a fashionable restaurant in Mayfair the other day with a guy who's very well educated, knows Australia well and everything, and he used that old convict stick thing, you know. It's a cliche. He knew it was a cliche, but he couldn't resist using it. Now, to some extent, we can't go forward while this sort of stuff is still hanging there with that kind of umbrella over decent, honest, terrific nationals who still see it as a stain.
Well,
it's always going to be like that.
I guess when I grew up, it wasn't a stain, it was a badge of courage, and I feel really sad I don't have convict ancestors. That's all I ever knew. But these people, many of them started the discourse of the stain, and particularly the buggery discourse, you know, so the Americans in particular were fearful of their chastity on board the hulks, the ones that were in London on board the ships, and they were forever, to read their pamphlets, there's a great deal of double penal anxiety, if I can say that. But they, so some of them create that anxiety. I guess what's interesting, I think it's because we perceive history in nationalist terms, though. So in Scotland, there's a huge monument to the Scottish martyrs, and they're ticked, you know, they were celebrated when the Great Reform Bill went through the House of Commons. In Ireland, there are many monuments to many of these people, and Smith O'Brien, and they're known, and in America, for those that went to America. I think Australia has trouble clinging on to people that went back. So this notion of transnationality causes problems. I also think we weirdly don't remember all of those. The bulk of the 3,600 political stayed. And it's as if we've only got 200 years to work with of white settlement. It's not a long period of time. And yet we have difficulties differentiating these fellas and some women, particularly cattle maimers from Ireland. They didn't break machines in Ireland. They maimed cattle. That was their form of industrial sabotage. But that we have trouble differentiating them from Fagin and the pickpockets. So everyone just knows the criminal story. And Manning Clark wrote an article back in the 50s saying most of them were, don't say they were poor, put upon people, most of them were criminal class and pretty bad. I think he's probably right. But that doesn't mean we can't know about identifiable names on records of people that weren't. So I guess my book and the documentary that may be coming in its wake, because there's a film company that's optioning it, will help address that. But many people have written about them, but it's been in the discourse of academia, and my book is more a narrative history, or it's been a few decades ago and forgotten. But, you know, there are fine books. But I get back to another thing. A good Australian film can come out, everyone will blow about it, you'll read about it in all the papers and we'll forget about it 5 years later. And I believe, as a cultural historian, that part of being a colony is you remember the history of the metropolis and not your own. And, you know, there is a willful ignorance of all the details of the 200 years. We teach it badly. Victoria is particularly bad. I mean, Bob Carr did some silly things, he did some good things, and one of the good things he did was quite a reinvigorated Australian history in New South Wales schools. And I see the difference in the students I taught at Sydney Uni to the students in Victoria. It's coming back. The national curriculum specifically says humans have agency, so not just barren themes. It specifically says Australia in the world. They'll want to make a big deal about Asia, I'm sure, like they did in the 70s, but it must involve the empire. And that gives us a chance, I think, to reinvigorate this. But, you know, there are watersheds that occur, and maybe Australia becoming a republic eventually will be something that triggers it. But it's probably more likely to be triggered by getting a mini-series up.
Justin, let me go down the back there. Yep.
On the subject of the type of republic you think might eventually come, if one does come here, the figures that you had up on the screen tonight, if they were delegates to a convention to decide on the model for a republic, they presumably mostly would want an elected head of state. Do you think that if we are to have a successful push for a republic, that as the polls showed in 1999, the wider population did want to elect its head of state, and how much of the history of the Republic of Ireland and its elected presidency is sort of an explanation for how we can go about it successfully if we want to go down that route?
Oh, I think absolutely we should have an elected head of state, not not the two-thirds majority. That was always my view. But I'd rather elect public boards and local school authorities and elect the board of the ABC. I think the delegates would be saying, gee, you've got a colonial constitution still? Because a colonial... In England or America, there are elections all over the place for all sorts of things or other modes of choice. A colonial constitution... Well, colonial streetscape in Melbourne or Calcutta is a grid pattern. But the other part of a colony is you send authorities in the name of the crown out from the centre, from the city, the fort, to control the frontier and run things. So in Australia, an edifice called the New South Wales Education Department is a monolith. And it's, to me, it's a colonial institution. The ABC, to me, is a colonial institution. In the BBC, you see autonomy in local BBC, BBC Wales, Yorkshire, Northern Ireland. We oddly have a very... those things are colonial, and I want to see more elections. I want accountability is what they went on about more than heads of state. John Keane, Professor John Keane, has come back from Britain. He's got a book, Life and Death of Democracy, talks about monitory, not monetary, but monitory democracy, means by which people are held accountable. And the Americans have devices for this, and we've historically had devices. And I think that's more important than bills of rights, actually. And ombudsmen are part of that and other things. But old corruption is what, if you read E.P. Thompson's book, The Making of the English Working Class, they talk about, the Liberals talked about, and corruption is a canker. And I'm not saying New South Wales is an especially corrupt place, but I could. It feels like that compared to Victoria, but then who knows what we'll uncover with the new government in Victoria. But we need to be vigilant against that. So for my kind of republicanism is concerned with extending democracy.
Yes, it's down the back there, yeah. No, behind you, yeah, up against the wall. Yeah. No, behind you, yeah.
You.
No, you go first.
Okay. Wouldn't it be nice to have our own talk, Phil? And the reason that I say that is because that's a scene by the character, the guy that becomes his own jailer, and at the same time, kind of an anti-Japan from the Wizard of Oz. Is there enough material that you've encountered in your look at him to flesh him out a bit as our own prison reformer, which of course Alexis de Tocqueville was on his tour of New America when he wrote about Democracy in America?
Sir, you've just given me a scathingly brilliant idea. Thank you. I think it would make a great historical novel it's something that I'm sure that there is a French-Canadian documentary I've heard about in which he is part, and I'd just love to have a broad global sweep that ends in Dapto. That could be good.
So just for those listening on our podcast, the question was, should we or can we have a to talk to them, right? Okay, just for the podcast. Now, there's a question down there, and then we go on. Yep.
Considering that we have had a lot of changes, social and political changes, from the time you described to today, how do you explain the fact that we still today have problems about freedom of speech, just like at that time? Because even today, at least one Canadian and one American suggested to assassinate Julian Assange. How do you explain that sort of
thing? I think the cause of liberty requires, the defence of liberty requires eternal vigilance. It's a bit like sex, every generation wants to get into it. There were licences placed on the press up to the 1850s in Britain, and in the end they gave up on that, but in Ireland they brought in new legislation because of the potato famine and the rabble-rousing by the young islanders. So they got rid of it and brought it back. And we saw national emergencies occur where there's a debate. And sometimes some things need to be secret for whatever reason to do with war. And there'll always be a debate. But I tell my students that media democracy marches hand in hand with political democracy, and it did. There's a wonderful book by a fellow called John Hartley, who's an Australian, and he looks at America, Australia, the French Revolution, and it's all about how journalism is the sort of DNA and script of modernity and modern democracy. So liberal democracy, Habermas was the original guy. He wrote about the public sphere, which emerges within the bourgeoisie because they need accurate, truthful knowledge to make investment decisions. And newspapers kind of evolve out of that. And there's this friction always between particularly business or the bourgeoisie in the 19th century and those that wished to control the press. And different classes emerge, different interests, different groups, different religions, and it's sort of a constant. How to solve it? I'm not convinced I'm not opposed to an American-style amendment, but I'm not convinced that would do it, because in America, what it is it's got to be defence. You know, it's about going to court about these issues, I guess, in the end, and the rule of law. And sometimes, though, you have to protest if you think it's wrong, and maybe you have to go to jail if you think it's wrong.
Okay. Yeah.
Quick one. I was really taken with your comment
about...
this
might be the final question here.
...the idealism and the writers and poets. And I remember when going to Dublin a year or two ago and seeing the 1915 revolution or where it happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the post.
All the people there were not soldiers, they were hopeless. They were never going to succeed as a revolutionary because they were writers and poets, and that Polish, or the lady from Lissadell House who was married to Constance, who was married to the Polish count or whatever. And none of them had a clue about how to do a decent revolution or whatever. Is there something in the Irish genes that the folk tales and the myths and things that causes this strain of poetry and idealism?
Look, I'm not a... Well, my Irish ancestry is about one quarter or even less, and I've lost contact with those roots. But researching the book, I was taken by the Irish folk culture, and Anne might be better to talk about this than me, has a, you know, it was harnessed in a genuine way, as it was in Poland in the 19th century, by urban intellectuals. For exactly the point of national independence and change. And it wasn't... There was a lot of effort. Trinity College, Trinity University in Dublin was involved, and people like Oscar Wilde's mother, the poet Eva Kelly, and they wrote beautiful stuff. And, it's a literate culture. In the Dark Ages, it was literate. So I think there's a lot in that. The Aborigines here have their oral culture, and, you know, that's to the extent that any of that is preserved is valuable. The Bulletin deliberately was inspired by The Nation, their newspaper, and American papers, and sought to do that. And what it all takes effort. You have to organise for this. They had outreach to the bush, to the shearing sheds, to the pubs, and to find the painter called Henry Lawson, who could write beautifully, to find Banjo Patterson, to find My Brilliant Career. These people, you know, you need a democratic outreach amongst the people to have that kind of both folk and high culture that fuse to do that. And I believe things happen in particular points. You know, Oz Rock, that music thing in the 1980s or the film thing in the 1970s wasn't accidental. Here, there were policies put in place and people, entrepreneurs. That's what I find when I look at these people. A lot of them are very entrepreneurial. They're certainly not dead hand bureaucrats. All the dead hand bureaucrats were running the jails. And that's why they kept escaping. Thanks.
Well, many thanks, Tony. So thanks for coming along tonight for your third occasion at the Sydney Institute. And I certainly learnt a lot tonight. I'm sure we all did, because I guess I've read a bit about Australian history, but some of you filled a lot of gaps about late 18th century and through the first half of the 19th century, and about the radicals who came here and some who remained and some who went back. So congratulations on your book. I think when you first told me you're doing a PhD, I didn't know it was going to be a readable one. So
that's not the PhD.
There you go.
The PhD's on Bohemians.
Oh, that's the unreadable one, is it? This but is the readable one.
That's the readable
one. Oh, I see.
The PhD will be out in readable form in a year's time. I'll be happy to come back. No, a year and a half's time.
Okay, well, you're welcome back. We'd like to have you back, I'm sure. That's right, Anne, isn't it? But for the moment... Yeah, well, look, this could have been the PhD. I mean, look.
You know. Some academics in their reviews would disagree, but the press would agree.
Well, I think we should vote for PhDs, as you were saying in your speech. We should vote for them. And if we're going to vote some in, we should be allowed to vote some out. Anyway, look, it's an entertaining talk tonight, an informative talk tonight. It'll up on our podcast within a couple of days. Be published by Anne in the Sydney Papers online, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of the book outside. But for tonight, well done, Dr. Moore. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.